2020-740, Disciplinary Counsel versus Anthony John Polizzi, Jr. For the respondent, we have Ms. McGee. If you'll unmute.
That seems important to do.
Proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Natalie McGee, Supreme Court number 0092122, and I represent respondent Mr. Anthony Polizzi. At this time, I would request to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal conducted by co-counsel Ms. Catherine Woodford.
Proceed.
Okay. Both relator as well as the board are asking this court to determine that Mr. Polizzi should be disbarred based upon, as the board describes it, heinous conduct he engaged in involving minors, conduct the board states places a stain on the teaching profession. The board acknowledged in its decision at paragraph 45 that this court has generally issued indefinite suspensions where respondent engages in sexual conduct with minors. See Disciplinary Counsel versus Grossman, 2015 Ohio 2340. In that case, this court held that an indefinite suspension adequately protects the public, deters other lawyers from similar wrongdoing, and preserves the public's trust in the legal profession. The behavior in that case involved a conviction for child pornography possession, as well as admissions to attempting to meet an 11-year-old boy's father to arrange for sexual conduct between respondent and the child. In spite of this finding, the board found that their perception of Mr. Polizzi's lack of remorse justifies disbarment. The board never expressly states that it believes Mr. Polizzi is incapable of rehabilitation. This is very important, as per this court's precedent, Mr. Polizzi's conduct alone does not warrant disbarment. The court has held that its duty requires more than just to protect the public from those ethically unfit to represent them, but also to be careful not to deprive the public of those who, through sufficient rehabilitation, may be able to recover their ethical orientation and serve competently in a professional capacity. And that quote is from Ohio State Bar Association versus Johnson, 2002 Ohio 3998. Upon a review of the 2019 disciplinary hearing transcript, Mr. Polizzi issues apology after apology, not only for his criminal conduct, but also the conduct he engaged in after that criminal conduct with the victims, as well as the insensitive statements that he made during his 2018 sentencing hearing. He testified about his extensive community service and provided letters from former clients, as well as his former wife, who, although she too had been victimized by his conduct, wrote that the incidents were so out of character and that she had not witnessed any deviant behavior before or after, in addition to stating that she had seen his remorse and regret and that she had seen him take responsibility for his actions. Respondent was a teacher for about 4 years prior to working at Cornerstone, the school where these incidents occurred, as well as nearly 2 years at Cornerstone itself without any incidents. He practiced law for 4 years without accusations of sexual misconduct as well. His conduct with these victims was a lapse in judgment that lasted yet less than a year total over the span of his entire professional career. This testimony and other evidence was largely ignored. When discussing the rationale for disbarment, both the board as well as the relator cite an email that Mr. Polizzi sent in 2012 as resounding evidence that first, Mr. Polizzi was not remorseful 7 years later during the 2019 disciplinary hearing, and additionally imply that Mr. Polizzi can never have the remorse necessary to be reinstated as an attorney and meet his burden by clear and convincing evidence that, among other requirements, he's a proper person to be readmitted to the practice of law. Respondent's misconduct with the victims after the sexual relationships ended does not suggest that he can't be trusted to represent clients here in the future. The board is seeking to disbar Mr. Polizzi because they are offended by his conduct. The strong wording used to describe his crimes illustrates as much. This is contrary to the primary purpose of discipline, which is to protect the public, not punish the offender. This is additionally the purposes of, this mirrors the purpose of felony sentencing, and Mr. Polizzi is currently undergoing rehabilitation at the hands of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. The court has made similar findings, even where overwhelming remorse was not present, in Columbus Bar Association versus Lennon, and the cite to that is 2006 Ohio 5480. The court followed the board's recommendation for an indefinite suspension because respondent may be able to sufficiently demonstrate in the future that he can return to the competent, ethical, and professional practice of law. Here, the panel and the board also determined that respondent did not genuinely acknowledge the wrongful nature of his conduct. I would note for the court today that the respondent was reinstated to the practice of law in 2014, meaning he was able to overcome his failure to acknowledge that had previously been present and show the court that he was ready to re-enter the profession. Respondent,
counsel, do you have any examples of someone who's been sentenced to 33 years in prison having their law license reestablished?
So I would note for the court that respondent was originally sentenced to 33 years in prison. However, that case was appealed, it was remanded, he was sentenced to 28 years by the same judge, and that case is actually up for resentencing again. But no, I don't have any other cases that have such a lengthy sentence. However, I think this dovetails in our assessment of his conduct and kind of what that conduct indicates for the practice of law. In other cases where the respondents were disbarred for sexual misconduct involving minors, there is this additional level of dishonesty that is not present in this case. So for instance, in Cleveland Bar Association versus Lockshin, 2010 Ohio 2207, the respondent was indefinitely suspended because he had not received the treatment necessary to prevent reoffending. He denied a lot of the allegations against him, although he did ultimately admit to inappropriate sexual communications with five clients, potential witnesses, and even a sergeant. And his most serious conduct that I think is the most similar to Mr. Polizzi's is a situation he had with a 16-year-old client whom he was representing. He had been appointed to be her counsel for a juvenile case. He continued to press personal questions with her, completely and totally unrelated to her case. And then even after the case continued, he had inappropriate instant messages with her, flirtatious and sexual in nature. Originally, because they both used screen names, this girl did not realize that she was talking to her former counsel, but as soon as she realized that that's who it was, she ceased the communications. He was then reappointed to become her counsel, visited her at the juvenile detention center, started engaging in inappropriate conversations, playing footsie, touching her leg, and eventually he told her that he was sexually aroused. Then at the hearing, he actually blamed the girl for the communications they had had via instant messaging and saying that he terminated the communications when she mentioned sex. So this is kind of the victim blaming. These are the additional indicia of dishonesty that are present in more serious cases that involve actual, I guess in that case, he wasn't definitely suspended, but that involved disbarment. But a case that does involve disbarment is Disciplinary Counsel versus Ostheimer. And the cite to that is 72 Ohio State 3rd, 304, 1995. In that case, respondent was disbarred. He pled guilty to felony counts of attempted sexual penetration and forgery for deceiving and coercing his adopted daughter into submitting to sexual demands for at least 3 years. And he did this by fabricating court documents to substantiate that this girl had been placed in a drug use probation program. He would present to her various documents that appeared to be signed by the court that directed her to submit to strip searches, ostensibly to verify that she was not a drug user. He continued to fabricate documents and eventually engaged in both digital penetration and sexual intercourse with his adopted daughter.
Counsel,
yes.
Let me ask you to address paragraph 50 of the report, which reads, "The most disturbing evidence that supports disbarment in this case is respondent's victim shaming. He stated he wanted his victims, who were minor students at the time of misconduct, to experience the misery and characterize the victim's statements as exaggerations. The fact that respondent at the time of the hearing stated the victim's statements were exaggerations does not demonstrate a person who has accepted full responsibility of his actions. Even more, respondent's testimony shows that there's no guarantee he would not engage in this type of behavior if he were able to practice law and potentially represent vulnerable clients. Respondent's sexual offenses against his minor victim students are egregious and reprehensible, but his subsequent actions and lack of acceptance of responsibility are just as abhorrent." Could you address that paragraph, please?
Thank you. he did acknowledge that his conduct was reprehensible. He acknowledged that it was abhorrent. He apologized for the subsequent conduct that occurred after the sexual conduct was over. I think that in particular, the court is talking about a 2012 email. It was very vulgar. He admitted during the hearing it was vulgar. He apologized for it. I think, honestly, we would also say that this is not quite victim shaming. He at no point ever said that these women contributed to his crimes against him. He didn't say that their actions, you know, increased his the rationale for his conduct. And actually, in 2018, during his sentencing, initially he had intimated that perhaps there was some consent between the parties. In 2019, at his disciplinary hearing, he demonstrated a lot of growth. And he actually testified that he realizes now that those relationships are not consensual and they never could be consensual by virtue of the student-teacher relationship. He says, "What I really regret is sounding like there was blame for other people. The blame is on me. I was in a position of authority. And so what I regret is perhaps saying that things were consensual. When you're in a position of authority, they are not. I tried to convey how sorry I was, but I guess if I had to take that back, I would be using other words." So he does admit that, yeah, originally he did have some issues with accepting, I guess not accepting responsibility, but with acknowledging the wrongfulness of his conduct, but he continues to grow and move forward. And I would say that his change in opinion regarding consent indicates that personal growth and shows that rehabilitation that would be necessary for him to be readmitted to the practice of law. So I think that additionally, even though he did dispute some of the conduct that occurred, he did admit that the victims were overall correct, and he's not denying that they have experienced pain and suffering at his hands. There is another case that has been discussed, Linen, which I think I was talking about earlier, where the panel had indicated that there were some issues with accepting of responsibility, and the respondent was ultimately reinstated. In that case, he pled guilty to 53 misdemeanors. And in its brief, the relator attempts to distinguish this case, arguing the fact that respondent pled to low-level misdemeanors makes this different. That was also sexual misconduct. They were all sex crimes. And in that case, he had actually attempted to circumvent admitting that he was wrong by obtaining a diagnosis from a medical professional that discussed a potential mental illness at the intersection of a sex addiction and obsessive compulsive disorder. Mr. Polizzi has done nothing of that nature and has continued to accept responsibility and acknowledge his conduct more so as time goes forward, indicating that that rehabilitation has been occurring. Another thing I think that I would like to touch on.
The Linen case didn't involve any kind of touching, sexual touching.
No, but he sought out victims repeatedly. He was flashing, and then he would actually document their reactions.
Correct. Thank you.
Yes. So respondents' relationship with the victims as a teacher has been highlighted by the board and throughout the relator's arguments. This is very serious conduct, and we don't want to minimize that. But the student-teacher relationship, though similar, is not the same as an attorney-client relationship. And one aspect of this uneven power dynamic is age, something that will never be an issue ever again, as respondent now is a tier 3 sex offender and his teaching license has been suspended. And as I indicated to the court previously, where the attorney-client relationship has been abused, most instances of misconduct don't actually end in disbarment. And those that do are distinguishable, as there's an additional layer of dishonesty that goes to the heart of whether one is ever going to be able to practice as an attorney in the future. I think that another case that's important to note for the court this morning is Disciplinary Counsel versus Wanner. It's 15 Ohio State 3rd, 319 from 1984. In that case, the respondent was indefinitely suspended for sexual conduct with much younger females. The relator argues this behavior is not as bad because there were only two instances of conduct as opposed to Mr. Polizzi's 8. However, both instances involved sexual intercourse with 17-year-old girls. And although respondent did not commit these offenses in an attorney-client capacity, he was an attorney at the time that this conduct occurred. Additionally, he himself was a parent in a girls' group home. So we have two additional factors that are much more concerning than Mr. Polizzi's conduct. First, that parent substitute is a much more serious relationship, I would say, than the student-teacher relationship. Additionally, because these girls were in a group home, they were even more vulnerable than the victims that were Mr. Polizzi's students at the time of his misconduct. There was, this relationship was even more fraught with an unequal power dynamic that's problematic, and that would—
Counsel, not only his behavior as a teacher with these vulnerable students, but had he been honest, he would not even be an attorney. Do you agree with that?
It's possible, Your Honor.
Well, if he would have disclosed on his application to law school, on his character and fitness, or any of the other numerous opportunities that someone has when they're aspiring to be an attorney, he would not have been an attorney.
Well, I think that this has been brought up before, and it's unfair to expect somebody in Mr. Polizzi's position with a wife and a family, including an autistic child, to expect this disclosure on their bar application.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
Yes, I think that this has been brought up before, and I think it would be unfair to expect somebody in Mr. Polizzi's position. I guess some people would do it, but it would be unfair to expect that this would happen when they have an autistic child, a wife, and two other children to care for.
You think that was a justification for dishonesty to the profession?
I'm not trying to justify his behavior, but I am saying that it is a mitigating factor.
But what about the fact he was terminated from the Christian school? I mean, wouldn't he be required to disclose that?
He did disclose that. Okay. Yes, that was disclosed. So it wasn't, you know, entirely fabricated. This wasn't all falsehoods, but he did know that that was.
There was no charge of falsifying his application, correct?
No.
I mean, so he did disclose that he was terminated, and whether there was an inquiry as to why he was terminated from the school, I'm not sure, but arguably there wasn't enough inquisition to ask why, or for some reason the board or character didn't find out why. Is there any other question or inquiry made by the character and fitness group that would have solicited the response, I engage in sexual conduct with minors?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Megan.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice O'Connor and other distinguished members of the court, my name is Leah Meehan, and I represent the relator in this matter, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. We ask that you adopt the findings in the board's report and impose the board's recommended sanction of permanent disbarment for two reasons. Number one, respondent's egregious misconduct warrants disbarment. And number two, the aggravating factors present in this case outweigh any minimal mitigation. Before I get into my argument, I would like to address several of my opposing counsel's arguments, though. Opposing counsel represented to this court that Mr. Polizzi made apology after apology throughout the disciplinary process. While that may be true, I think it shows that Mr. Polizzi, the respondent, knows the right words to say. He knows that it's expected of him to come in and say that has apologized and he's remorseful. However, the board looked into more detail than that. When you compare his statements with the evidence, they contradict. For example, Mr. Polizzi testified at the disciplinary hearing that he admitted to the charges to avoid a painful trial for his family and to avoid 405 years in prison. He thought that he was going to get probation or 6 months in prison. There's no indication that he actually pled to protect the victims, to accept full responsibility. And that was something he actually testified to at the disciplinary hearing just last year. In 2012, the email that my opposing counsel referenced, he sent one of the victims a sexually explicit email in which he failed to identify himself and explicitly recounted the abuse. But at the disciplinary hearing, he told the panel that he sent that email for closure. That doesn't make sense. Why would you send an anonymous email in which you explicitly recount the abuse for closure? He also told a psychologist in 2018 at the time of his sentencing that he wished for the victims to experience misery. I think this is one of those examples of victim shaming that was brought up earlier that the panel was concerned with.
Counselor, how is that victim shaming? I guess my idea of victim shaming is, you know, accusing them of being promiscuous or the way they dress or, you know, encouraging him or soliciting him. How is saying, you know, it's disturbing to say, I wish the victims would suffer some misery. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Misery for this coming out, misery in that, you know, they regret that this happened. So I'm not sure what that means, but how is that victim shaming?
So I think the full quote was actually that he wished for them to experience misery for what they had done to him. And I think that absolutely is victim shaming, because that's holding them responsible for consequences due to his action. He's holding them responsible for this coming to light, for coming
but
to
how, but how is that shaming them? That's you're right. It's not taking responsibility and putting the onus on minors and not taking, showing that he hasn't taken full responsibility. But how is that shaming them?
I think it's shaming them for coming forward. I guess, let me give you another example of victim shaming. At the at the sentencing hearing in 2018 in his criminal case, Mr. Polizzi told the court that one of the victims, NM, was more sexual than EL was. EL was more innocent. NM tended to be more aggressive, and I guess I liked that she was more aggressive. He stated that he liked the attention. I think it was mutual. And he said everything was by consent. This was 2018, after he had been a licensed attorney. And I think the disciplinary panel absolutely was properly took that into consideration when determining this. These statements were made 10 years after the abuse of one of the girls. It's been a decade. At this point, he should have made progress. He should recognize the errors in his ways. And instead, he's going to the sentencing for his criminal case and making these statements, blaming the victims. So I think when you look in the grand scheme of his behavior and his statements, it shows that it does not mesh with his statements to the disciplinary panel that he is remorseful.
Was the panel concerned that, or do you think that the recommendation and the sanction would be any different? These crimes committed were committed while he was not an attorney, but then some of the subsequent acts, the follow-up, the communications happened when he was. Is that the part that aggravates the scenario? So had the crime still occurred, for which he's being punished by incarceration, and then there was no further contact, would disbarment still be an appropriate sanction?
I think disbarment would still be an appropriate sanction, just given the egregious nature of the misconduct in this case. But I think you're right that the panel looked at really the pattern of conduct. So it's not just the offenses that occurred, although egregious, and I believe they would still support disbarment. But then you look at the continued pattern of his behavior throughout the next decade. And this is an opportunity we don't really get in many disciplinary cases, because the length of time between the misconduct and the disciplinary hearing is not a decade. In this case,
there's clearly some, you know, failure to take responsibility, personality problems, et cetera. But how, I'm trying to equate, was there damage done to any clients? Did this impact his practice of law negatively?
No, I wouldn't say there was an impact to any clients in this matter. He was an attorney for, I think, 3 or 4 years before the indictment. So still a very new attorney working at a large firm. But I don't think that's the only factor that we need to look at, honestly.
No, it's not the only factor. I was just inquiring about the implications of his conduct and his choices on the practice of law.
I think the panel expressed that they are concerned if he is given access to vulnerable victims in the future. So I guess that would be the impact that we would need to be avoiding here by issuing disbarment, is that at this point he hasn't shown that he is remorseful or even really understands the impact. He testified at the disciplinary hearing and the sentencing.
But that's today. By the time he gets out of prison, arguably he'll be a different person. Right. And even if he's indefinitely suspended, that still doesn't mean he'll ever be licensed to practice law again.
That's true.
Isn't a disbarment under this circumstance more of a punishment?
No, I think in this case, really, the court's decision in Calabrese, I think, controls. The court in Calabrese found that while the primary purpose of the disciplinary process is to protect the public and not punish the offender, there are times when to maintain public confidence in the integrity of our profession, permanent disbarment is appropriate. And I think this is absolutely one of those cases where this applies. He shouldn't be given the opportunity to be in a position of trust and authority again. I think he's shown over this pattern of time, this length of time, that he is not worthy of that trust at this point.
Do you agree with what the Chief Justice asked or at least suggested earlier on, that had he been forthright, assuming that there was the need to be somewhere in the questioning in his application process, had he been forthright, that he would not have been able to be an attorney?
Yes, I think that's absolutely possible. Or even if he admitted, you know, to the school when asked, he denied sexual conduct. He just said he was off campus with a student, and that's why his employment was terminated with the school. He had multiple opportunities before being licensed as an attorney to come forward with his conduct, which would have led to an earlier indictment. But the fact that he concealed his conduct until after he became an attorney, he shouldn't get a benefit from that. I believe it absolutely is possible that he would not have been admitted to the practice of law. Unfortunately, the Bar Admissions Committee was denied that opportunity.
Thank you.
My co-counsel went through a couple different cases, and I just want to continue to distinguish those. I feel actually that the cases that she brought up in support of her position also support my position. She brought up the Ostheimer case, basically saying that if there's no dishonesty, then disbarment isn't appropriate because there was dishonesty in Ostheimer. However, I believe Ostheimer stands for more of the proposition that it was a parent and adopted daughter, and it was more of a coercive relationship. So Ostheimer fabricated court documents to make her think that she had to undress for part of her court probation, and then he engaged in sexual conduct with her. I think that's similar in this case. In the sentencing proceedings, it was brought up that respondent told the girls that they would be expelled if they told anyone. So there was the coercive nature there. Also, he admitted to gross sexual imposition being committed by force or threat of force, one count for each victim. So I think that further shows that there was this element of coercion. It wasn't mutual, it couldn't be mutual. And the court indeed found that. In the Lockshin case, I believe that supports our position too, that disbarment is appropriate. In that case, as my co-counsel said, there was actually no sexual contact between Lockshin and his minor client, and he still got an indefinite suspension. So we should be treating respondent's case more significantly and more egregiously than a case where there was no contact. In fact, it was just words and footsie, I believe. So absolutely, where there's a case where a gross sexual imposition was committed by force, there was 8 counts of felony sex offenses, we should absolutely be treating that more significantly. My co-counsel also brought up the Wanner case from 1984. As she stated, Wanner was actually only committed of 2 sex offenses, and neither of those sex offenses were committed by force. There was also no evidence that Wanner committed his sex offenses over a period of time. I believe my co-counsel said that this was only a 1-year period of time. I don't think that's accurate. I think that the evidence showed that he began the abuse with one victim in 2007 through 2008. That victim graduated. There was a break in time, and then he found a second victim and continued the abuse with that second victim until 2010. So there was a significant period of abuse, and he even had the opportunity to think to himself, you know what I just did was wrong. Instead of doing that, he continued with a second victim a year later. There's been no evidence presented that respondent is going to be able to be rehabilitated and fit to practice law in Ohio in the future. In fact, the board did express concern if he were to continue to practice law, that he would have access to vulnerable victims. At this point, this is a pattern of 10 years where respondents continue to abuse his victims, minimize his misconduct, and blame his victims for his crimes. The pattern continued even through the time when he was attorney and through the disciplinary process. This court must consider this pattern, as it shows that respondents consistently chosen the wrong path and fails to be forthcoming with facts. At this point, we believe that disbarment is the only sanction that ensures that respondent will no longer hold a position of trust and authority in the legal profession. Therefore, we ask that you adopt the board's findings and permanently disbar the respondent from the practice of law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll introduce myself briefly. My name is Catherine Woodford, Supreme Court number 0097830, on behalf of the respondent, Anthony Polizzi. I will be brief. I want to start with the issue of that keeps coming up of a lack of remorse and a lack of willingness to acknowledge the wrongfulness of his conduct. A failure to accept responsibility. I think it's important to note that in Realtor's brief, Relator's brief, they cite that when deciding between indefinite suspension and disbarment, the court must assess whether an attorney may in the future be rehabilitated and fit to practice law. So I think what we would argue that is important here is to consider whether or not the evidence presented demonstrates that the respondent is never going to be fit to practice law. We would argue that that has not been demonstrated. In looking at this court's past cases, the courts do award indefinite suspension where they feel that the suspension would protect the public, but also give the respondent the time needed to address his issues as well, demonstrate that he is ready to resume the competent, ethical, and professional practice of law. This is the case of Dayton Bar Association versus Bellato, 2014 Ohio 5063. To summarize this case briefly, the respondent suffered from a sexual addiction. He was having issues with viewing online pornography. And had issues with possession of pornography. So even though the board found that he hadn't, at the time of the hearing, demonstrated that he had attained a sustained period of successful treatments, he still stated that it was his goal to work towards being able to become ready to practice law, and the court did allow him this opportunity. That's very similar to this case where respondent isn't arguing that he's ready to practice law or that he will be in the position to be fit to practice law in the next couple of years. He's just asking for the opportunity to work towards this goal. And there's no evidence to suggest that at the time his sentence is over, that he will not be fit to practice law. And I think that another important thing to mention is to focus on the cases where this court does find that disbarment is appropriate. And as my co-counsel mentioned, that those are cases where there's an additional element of dishonesty, attempts to fraud the court or to perjure himself. In this case, while the conduct is egregious, once this investigation got started, he cooperated and he has made significant growth since the beginning of this process.
Counsel, do you think that he was obligated to disclose his sexual criminal activities when he applied for law school?
So, I think that when he applied for law school, I'm not sure if any of the questions are the bar exam was specifically would have elicited the response that would require disclosure in this case.
What about when he went through the character and fitness evaluation?
His obligation at that time would have been to disclose his termination, which he did. So I think that he was forthcoming in that regard. He did disclose that there was a termination as a result of that. And there was some discussion from him at sentencing that he at that time thought that the relationship was consensual. And as we later testified, he now realized that is wrong. It was not consensual. But at the time of going through the bar exam application, he may not have thought that it was something that was warranted disclosure.
All right. You've taken your time. Thank you very much. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.
Thank you.
Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.